Good morning, friends. I'm Asha Nayaswamy. We're continuing with our Sheltering in Place morning conversations. We've been working with and will be for a few more days the Way of Ananda Sanghis, which is this beautiful document that Swami wrote in 2003. The whole story of it and what I'm reading can be found also in the Light Bearer toward the end of 2003, that chapter. So we'll begin with a prayer and we'll offer the prayer of the Ananda Sanghis. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow to all. May the divine light awaken and purify our hearts and bring enlightenment to all beings. Om, peace. Amen. So we're in the sub-points of point number two of the 7 points here. The first was we believe in a single blissful reality underlying all creation, which is Satchidanandam. We believe that man's highest duty is to realize within himself that he is also an expression of the all-pervading Satchidanandam. Everything in the universe is existence, consciousness, bliss, and so are we. And then underneath this are these points about how we realize and express it in ourselves. First, and I read this yesterday, we embrace the way to self-realization through inner silence. And I spoke about the importance of that direct communion, separating ourselves out from this world. And then point number two is about relating to the world. We embrace for ourselves the need to embody this realization of Satchidanandam as our true reality. This realization in our lives by daily performing at least one specific, conscious, personally selected act of service to our fellow beings. I've always been intrigued by that. Later on, he speaks in a more general way about supporting all humanity. But as part of our commitment to being Ananda Sanghis, every day we must consciously, and the way he says personally selected, it's not like these are the, you know, this is what we do. We give alms to the poor. We say so many of these prayers in this way, or we give away a certain amount of money, or we spend a certain time in a soup kitchen. One personally selected act of service to our fellow beings. And I think it's just to keep it always in our minds that not just the implication is it's not just in the course of things. If it is your responsibility to make breakfast for your family, later that the way there's a reference to sort of how to make all of our duties divinely inspired. But I love the idea of getting up every morning and asking yourself, what is going to be my personally selected act of service to my fellow beings today? Fellow beings, you know, it doesn't even say human beings. It can be kindness to animals or even kindness to the plants and the trees. But one does it as a conscious expression of Satchidanandam and not just as another duty that I carry out. Now, of course, the implication behind this is that if we do one consciously selected act of service to our fellow beings, knowing that we're doing it in support, that man's highest duty is to realize himself as an expression of all-pervading Satchidanandam. If we consciously act as that instrument in one action every single day that is true to me, that isn't mandated from some authority that tells me, but is really my spontaneous feeling of how I feel God wants to express through me today to be of service to the people around me. You see, it can gradually transform your consciousness so that that experience becomes in itself so enjoyable that we figure why limit it to just one experience a day. When I was first living at Ananda Village, I was given the responsibility of running the kitchen at what was then the meditation retreat. It still is the meditation retreat, but we also have the expanding light. So that very secluded area was the only retreat we had at the time. And I was in charge for maybe a year and a half or 2 years of cooking basically three meals a day, 6 days a week. And on the seventh day, I went to town and bought groceries and did laundry and came back and started over. And we had all, it was the only temple we had. So all our Sunday services were at that location. And it was our practice that after Sunday service, everyone in the community would stay and we would share lunch. It was a lovely way for us all to be together. And Swami Kriyananda was beginning to give some responsibilities to Jyotish and a few others who were qualified to share these teachings and to be ministers. So he started giving Sunday service every other Sunday. And I had to cook lunch, and every Sunday that Swami came, I would plan it out all week. I would make it as, I wasn't particularly skilled, but I would make it as fine and elaborate a meal as I could in the context and work, you know, go in very early on Sunday morning and work hard to make it as good as I could. On the Sundays when Swami wasn't there, everybody still ate, but there was no comparison between the way I gave myself to the project when he was there and when he wasn't. And it gradually occurred to me that what I was enjoying when I made the fine meals was the love that was flowing through me, the opportunity to do my very best in order to please others. I mean, not to please others in a bad way, but to serve them, to give them the best that I had. And I began to realize that on the alternate Sundays, it was I who felt bad. I mean, the food was okay. People didn't expect necessarily anything more. But I felt bad because I was just deciding that they weren't important and that I would put out a lot of energy sometimes and the rest of the time I just wouldn't bother. So gradually it just became every Sunday I simply did the very best that I could. And that's what does happen to us. One personally selected act of service to our fellow beings as an instrument of Satchit Anandam will focus that experience until we realize this is the way I want to experience everything. Why would I limit this? So it becomes then not the sum total of our practice, but the minimum that we do. So we commune in silence. We feel God's presence within us. At least one time every day, we very consciously take that inner presence and we bring it out. You could see also that that act of service could be an extension of our sadhana. Right after meditation, I will, whatever that might be. So then we come to the third point. We embrace, and then Swami says, again for ourselves, since we seek not to impose our understanding on others, and this is also all through this document about what is an Ananda Sangha, is the fact that we exemplify and we share, but we never seek to impose. So again, we embrace, again for ourselves, since we seek not to impose our understanding on others, the need to honor all, whether friends or self-named foes, as manifestations of the eternal Satchit Anandam. He has that phrase, we honor all, whether friends, and then he says, or self-named foes. You know, in the course of Ananda's history, we've had a lot of opposition, you know, major opposition, minor opposition. But Swamiji has always used that phrase. He would never call anyone an enemy of Ananda or even not a friend of Ananda without saying self-styled, self-named. He would never call them that because we honor everyone as an equal expression. We honor all, whether friends or self-named foes, as manifestations of the eternal Satchit Anandam. This is, of course, the entire premise of the way of Ananda Sangha, that there is nothing in creation that is separate from the ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. And every molecule of the created world, in all three worlds, has to be equally Satchit Anandam, because there is nothing else. So we honor all friends and self-named foes. Also, they are not less a manifestation of God merely because they love us or don't love us. the fact of their divinity is simply their nature, and how they choose to express it is their freedom to decide. And to see them as our brothers and sisters in that supreme consciousness, which is variously called God, Ishvara, Allah, or Jehovah. We recognize all names for the Supreme Being as designating our one common progenitor, is the word he uses, progenitor, the source of all of us. So once we move down from the purity of Satchitanandam itself, the human mind starts dividing. Yesterday, in some context, I was talking about the fact that whereas we tend to think, because creation is so complicated, we imagine that the creator of this creation must be as complicated as the creation. And in the satsang in India about 2004, Swami just said how the mind tricks you into thinking that. But the closer you come to the source, the closer you come to oneness, and that oneness is absolutely still and absolutely silent. And far from being complicated, it's the essence of simplicity because it's singular. Everything is Satchitanandam. So when we move out, we have God, we have Allah, we have Ishvara, we have Jehovah. I mean, and then we have subsects and thousand names for Divine Mother and all of these different things, all of them branching out. But what we're trying to do as Sanghas is we're coming back to the inner silence. And in coming back to the inner silence, we're recognizing that there is just one reality that variously manifests. And when we know ourselves standing at that origin point, no matter how diverse the expressions, if we stand at the origin point, all we see is our unity. There is a beautiful tree in this courtyard here, the Guru tree, this elm. It's been there undoubtedly for decades and decades. It's a huge tree. Has a huge trunk. One has no idea how far out and deep the roots go, but you can see from the top that it just goes, you know, way into the sky and extends outward in so many different directions. But no matter how far, and because of the trees, some of the trees sort of grow into one another. I was on a balcony and relating to this tree branch, and I finally realized that it traced its root all the way back to that same original tree. But looking at it by itself, I would not have known that. It was only when I applied myself to tracing it back to its source that I realized that it was the same. It was the same life force. And this is what this is what Swamiji is saying is fundamental to being a Sanghi, that we recognize and honor, he says, to honor all, as whether friends or self-named foes, as manifestations of eternal Satchitanandam. Honoring them is even more than just recognizing. It's because everyone is a manifestation of God, that's where the capacity to love comes from. It's very much like the fingers of the hand. We seem so separate, and we can seem really quite divided from one another. But if one is perceiving it from the base, one realizes that all these manifestations are just this one reality. And when this manifestation is done, when the life force withdraws, it goes back into the same reality. Standing here, we can reach everyone equally. Now, Swami doesn't talk about it here, but that doesn't mean that we behave inappropriately. Because you can honor someone as a manifestation of Satchitanandam and recognize that that person's behavior is extremely hurtful, even dangerous to other people, and therefore stern action should be taken. When Master in other writings has talked about world peace and the United Nations and the League of Nations, because Master lived through all those things in the 1900s, he talked about the fact that there will always be international bullies. And as a consequence, there needs to be an international police force that will keep bullies in check, which is very interesting. And it goes back to the series I gave on These Principles We Stand, that Master was extremely practical in his idealism. But merely because that soul is behaving as a bully, even as a cruel bully, does not mean that he's any less Satchitananda. He's just taken his portion of the infinite and turned his back on the light. But in one's heart, in oneself, even if one must even go to battle and slay such a person, one can still do it without animosity. One can do it in the impersonal sense that this is my duty, that we are all brothers and sisters, and our mutual service at times is to be the disciplining force. And of course, most of us aren't on a battlefield, but often we have to be the disciplining force. And that's one of the ways we honor the potential of a person. You are not living up to your potential, and I'm not going to passively allow you to desecrate the Spirit of God which is within you. I'm going to honor it in me and in you by appropriately disciplining, or at least declaring what I believe to be the truth. But doing that from a point of view of shared divinity is quite different than us and them. When I was in, when I was engaged for a long time in the litigation that was against Ananda, which went on for 12 years, which was an effort basically to preserve a monopoly on Master's teaching and to not allow our original expression of Master's teaching to be allowed because another group wanted a monopoly. This is what happens. The first group in a spiritual movement has a monopoly by definition because they're the only one. But as something grows and as other souls are raised up in that and come into their own sense of their reality, there's almost inevitably some kind of a division. And it's either initiated by the first group and people are cast out, or it's initiated by the individual who feels the need to serve in another way. And then the first group tends to try by one means or another. In the medieval times, they would arrest and torture and put people in prison. In modern times, they use the courts. So I was in this for 12 years, and it got ugly. It got really very ugly for a period of time, and one particular really extremely unscrupulous person who had a law degree, as Swami said, so for the sake of being able to hurt people, was opposing us. A great deal of this story is woven into this book because it was such an important part of Ananda's history and Swamiji's destiny, an incredible teacher for us. And just now to finish this, there was a certain point in this legal proceeding. I was raised Jewish, but I don't look Jewish, as people say. And also, I just lived in places where it was never an issue. I was always in the West, and there's not the same kind of, you know, in some areas back on the East Coast of America, at least there used to be a lot more anti-Semitism. I think it's mostly gone from this country. But in any case, in California, where I lived, it really was never an issue. So I never in my life experienced it, and I never created it by the way I looked. I myself and a friend of mine were key people in these depositions that were happening. And she's African-American. So she also is a few years older than me, and she pioneered a great deal of desegregation. Her family, you know, desegregated a neighborhood. She was one of a handful who desegregated a college. She was actually the first Black woman to graduate from Harvard Law School. So she had a lot of firsts. And then she went to work with Martin Luther King. So this was all a big part of her reality. We would often talk about these things because, of course, the prejudice against her was visual. So there was no way that it wouldn't happen if it was going to happen. So she, of course, experienced much more than I did. I've never really experienced any. But I've always had this really hard time in my mind to understand Nazism, because many of those people were highly educated and in other areas of their lives quite refined. They looted a lot of art collections and had good taste about what they took, you know, and were musicians and things that you would consider. But nonetheless, they were able to perpetrate this brutal reality against the Jewish people. So I'd always wondered about that. So then my friend, Nydruva is her name, Nydruva and I were in this deposition or something with the worst lawyer and his sidekick, both of whom were terrible. And they were just being terrible. They were being rude and sort of insulting to us in this mocking sort of way. I mean, we were used to it. It didn't matter. But I had this sudden feeling that they had separated themselves from us on a very fundamental level. And the words I want to use are they had turned us into them. We were no longer ourselves. We were no longer two women with lives of our own, with a whole story that paralleled the lives of these attorneys in any way at all. We had just become them. And I could feel, because one of these men was, well, both of them were pretty awful. I said to Nydruva, you know, really, if they could have gotten away with it, I really believe they would have pulled out guns and just shot us dead and left us bleeding in the room. And I don't think that was an exaggeration, because I have no history of being paranoid about these things. That's why I said all that. But I could feel the way they treated us and dealt with us. They had just made us other than themselves. And I actually finally realized, of course, that's what the Nazis did. The Nazis were greatly refined and very, loving to their own, but the Jews had become other. And this is how all tragedies happen. You know, in Rwanda, tribes that had lived together for generations, suddenly these evil politicians persuaded them that they were different. This one is one and this is the other. So we can go and just slaughter the other. We can be unkind to the other. We can fire the other. We don't have to take care of the other. So this statement, we embrace, we're not trying to impose it, because you can't impose such a thing on people, that we are all manifestations of eternal Satchitananda. And to see friends and self-named foes even as our brothers and sisters. Misguided, necessary to be disciplined, but not different than me. Because if they're not fundamentally different than me, then there is always this bond of sympathy. There's always the possibility of drawing them forward. And this is why in the Festival of Light, Swami added the phrase, you know, a few years before he died, which was much later than the whole festival, God loves us all equally. Krishna, Jesus, all the great masters, and the worst sinner. How is God able to do that? It's not that he's blind to our behavior. Somebody said philosophically, to raise the philosophical point to Master, Master, I believe that God does not know evil. Master responded, God would have to be very stupid not to know evil. He said, evil is rampant. So this sense of unity transcends behavior. It's the only way also that one can offer that to others is also by knowing that's who I am. And when we start knowing that that's who I am, you see, it also changed my own relationship to the Spirit. Because if my fundamental nature is Satchitananda, then my salvation is assured. I may have to persuade myself to get rid of all these limiting self-definitions, but I don't have to create anything. And the more, you know, it works both ways. The more I see myself in that light, the easier it is to see others in that light. And the more I see others in that light, the easier it is to see myself in that light. I used to be very judgmental of other people's behavior and very judgmental of my own. It's been a long fight, and I dare say I've made a lot of progress. But I had this wonderful realization that helped me enormously at a certain point. I've had a lot of good friends. I have a lot of good friends in my life. I've been very blessed by that. And you know, some of them are self-evident, a sharing of personality and temperament and shared interests, you know, a love of humor or literature or something. And some of them are just karmic ties. It's just like we've been close in the past and we're close in this lifetime. And there's not, you don't have to see it beyond that. So in my early years at Ananda, I had a particular friend who was a little bit difficult, sort of kind of a feisty soul, tended to prefer the preemptive strike rather than waiting to see if someone was going to hurt her. But I don't know, I just karmically, there was nothing she could do that would upset me, no matter how awful she was sometimes. It just never bothered me. I loved her, and I knew that she loved me, and she was struggling with what she was struggling with. So no matter what she did, and quite often she did quite colorful things, I never felt anxious about her. I never felt judgmental, and I never felt anxious. It was just, well, something she has to go through. But then I began to realize that if I myself made any kind of a similar mistake, or even a much smaller mistake, and lost my temper, or spoke in the wrong way, or failed to come through when I had made a promise, then there would this deluge of self-condemnation would fall on me. And it finally crossed my mind that there was something a little confused here. Why was I so calm when this friend did it? What was the difference between her and me? We were essentially the same person in terms of our degree of delusion and our degree of realization. We were just sisters on the path. And I started pretending. Every time I did something and I started down that self-condemnation route, I would pretend that my friend had done it. And I would actually visualize her coming to me, sometimes weeping, telling me about whatever awful thing it was, except I would make it what the awful thing that I had done. And then I would watch how in my visualization, I would respond to her with calm comfort and the absolute assurance that it's going to be okay. And I thought to myself, what's the difference? You know, we're all equally loved. And it was very powerful for me. So Swamiji's advice here that we honor, and honor is a beautiful word, respect, but the need to honor, he says. He doesn't use the word respect here, he uses honor. Honor all as manifestations of Satchitananda. Their personalities and their actions may not be worthy of their true nature, but we honor them as the same as us. And when that becomes our habitual response to life, then it spills over naturally to ourselves, and we're able to live much more deeply in that realization, which is the whole point. We believe that man's highest duty is to realize himself as an expression of Satchitananda. We go into the inner silence. We consciously choose one act of service to our fellow creatures, and we honor everyone else on the planet, whatever they call themselves and whatever they think they're doing, as that we have a common father and a common divine mother. And our goal in life is to see the world as divine mother sees us, to see the world as master sees us. Master said to Swamiji one evening and to a group of monks, if you could see yourselves as I see you, he said, you would realize that you are nothing but beautiful light, just beautiful light. Isn't that a marvelous affirmation? When we look at the world around us, at all creatures, all human beings, all animals, all of God's flowers and trees, when we look in the mirror, what do we see? Do we see this limited egoic consciousness? Or can we be like Master and say, look at that, I and we are nothing but beautiful light. God bless.